I'd like to thank you all for coming and welcome you here. My name is Mark Brickell, and I'm an alumnus here for my 40th reunion, and I'm sure that many of you are here for similar reasons, if perhaps not as high-numbered. As you know, this is one of the first events to be held in this fabulous repurposed building. And later this month, it will become the new home of the Department of Economics, both the undergraduate and the PhD programs, and the home of the Gary Becker Milton Friedman Institute for Research in Economics. That makes the trips that we used to take over to the Social Sciences building a memory. No more of those memories will be built, but I certainly treasure mine, sometimes going in to talk about economics or a missed assignment, once walking in on Milton Friedman to ask him what he thought the proper student response should be when one of our student organizations, the Students for a Democratic Society, disrupted a 1974 lecture that Friedman had hosted right across the street in the Oriental Institute's Breasted Hall. I know that you, many of you, have your own memories because the University of Chicago is the intellectual home of the most powerful ideas in the field of economics. Over the last 70 years, the Chicago School has influenced policy. It's helped shape global economies, and perhaps most important, it's developed the tools that help us understand society in new and powerful ways. Books have been written not only by, but about the economists who have taught and studied here. This particular year has had its highs, including the awarding of Nobel Prizes to Jean Fama and to Lars Hansen, and the addition of significant new faculty hires. It's also had its lows. The recent death of Gary Becker, a towering figure in the field and the face of Chicago economics, was a huge loss. But we know that Gary was a champion for advancing the Chicago economic legacy, and that he viewed this building as an essential resource for that mission. So his spirit is with us this afternoon as we come together now to mark this momentous time in the history of economics at the University of Chicago. It's nice to know about that history. It's nice to treasure it. It's even nicer to help make it. And you are about to hear the first academic lecture given in this new hall. Later in the session, we will hear from our most recent Nobelist, Lars Peter Hansen. But first, it's my pleasure to introduce the current chair of the Department of Economics, John A. List. John is the Homer Livingston Professor in Economics and the College, and in addition, he holds a position as a National Bureau of Economic Research Associate. He is a University Fellow at Resources for the Future. He's a Research Fellow at the Institute for the Study of Labor. He's an Extramural Fellow at the Department of Economics, Tilburg. From 2002 to 2004, John served as a senior economist on the President's Council of Economic Advisors, and he has pioneered field experiments as a methodology for learning about behavioral principles that are shared across different domains. He's published over 150 peer-reviewed research publications, and he's provided insights into charitable giving, public goods provision, and the valuation of non-marketed goods and services. He received the 2010 Kenneth Galbraith Award and the 2008 Arrow Prize for senior economists for his research in behavioral economics and in the field. Please welcome John.
He did some serious research.
That's very kind. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So that was much too kind. So I was told I have 10 minutes. and then I should get off the stage for the real show. I want to begin by welcoming all of you back. And you are now sitting in what I believe to be the world's greatest building, which houses an economics department. That's how proud we are. In roughly 14 days. So my 10 minutes, I'm going to talk a little bit about my life. Basically, what is a chair's life like? Now, I think it's quite unique in our department because most of the rumors that you have probably heard about, they are all true and then some. Okay, so I do a bit of research, and I'll tell you about that to start. I do a bit of support of others, and I'm going to focus today on our hiring program and our recruitment of graduate and undergraduate students. But then at the end, every so often, you have a bit of fun. And we had a lot of fun beginning in October, which I'm going to end my 10 minutes in telling you a little bit about when I woke up one morning in October, what happened. Okay, so what is my research about? I'm essentially an economist who asks why. Why do people discriminate against one another? Now, Gary Becker did seminal work in the 50s on his dissertation, developing a very important economic theory about why people discriminate against each other. I ask questions such as, why do women earn less money than men in labor markets? I ask questions such as, why do inner city schools continue to struggle? And as was mentioned in the intro, I'm really interested in why people give to charitable causes. What keeps them committed to giving to the cause? And what factors or incentives can we use to get people to help our individual 501c3s or charities? These are some of the questions that I've been looking at using field experiments. Now, when you hear about experiments, my guess is you think of your days as an undergrad when you saw a sign or you were taking Psych 101 and you were asked to come in and take part in an experiment. How many of you have taken part in a psychology experiment? Please. Perfect. Okay, so that's not what I'm talking about here. Okay? Now, what I'm talking about here is something altogether different. It's going out into markets or the real world and learning about those questions. So let's figure out who are my experimental subjects. Who in here has flown United Airlines in the past few years? Please raise your hand if you've flown United Airlines in the past few years. Very good, quite a few of you. Who has given money to Smile Train, the Red Cross, or the Sierra Club in the past 5 years? Please raise your hand. Okay, fair number of you. Who in here has voted in either of the past two presidential elections? Please raise your hand. Okay, so my research suggests that about half of you are lying. Okay, but we'll get to which half later. Who in here has used search engines in the past few years for retail purposes? Please raise your hand. Okay. Has anyone not raised their hand at least once? Perfect. The guy who's lying. That's perfect. Because we know what all of you are now. All of you are my lab rats. All of you have helped me learn about the economic science without even knowing it. All of you are likely a subject in at least one of my experiments without even knowing it. Okay? Going to everyday markets, asking questions that we care about, using all of you to help me figure out which theories work in which environments. That's what my research is about. Now let's talk about the other bit of time that being chairman takes a fair amount of time to support our existing scholars and teachers. We have this big, beautiful building. And when I became chairman 2 years ago, we had 21 full-time faculty. Five of those 21 had Nobel Prizes already. Of the other 16, half of them thought they should have won the Nobel Prize already. So that takes a bit of time. We are currently working as hard as we can to recruit the best graduate and undergraduate students to come and be a part of Chicago Economics. We are also on a major hiring initiative in which we are trying to take our faculty of 21 up to 40. Okay, so far in the last 2 years, we've hired six people. We've hired two great senior scholars and four great junior scholars. Okay, so these are major initiatives which the department and I are spending a massive amount of time out trying to recruit the very best. Because when you look at the 20th century, nearly every major economic innovation of the 20th century has a link to Chicago Economics. We need to make sure that we can say the same thing about the 21st century. And that's what our renewal program is attempting to ensure right now. Okay? Now, there is a bit of real fun to this job. And the real fun actually occurred for me about 7 a.m. on October 14th. I received a phone call at 7 a.m. October 14th. Guess who the phone call was from? Anyone take a guess? Sweden wasn't calling me. I promise you, they were not calling me. Close. Bob Zimmer. What Bob Zimmer said is, John, get out of bed, grab a suit. Lars has just won the Nobel Prize in Economics. Now, the committee, you can't really read it here. The committee cited Lars' empirical analysis of asset prices. Lars developed a very important approach. If he wouldn't have been a recipient for asset prices, one could imagine that he could have been awarded empirical analysis of trade models, of regional and urban economics, of public economics, of labor economics. It could have really been empirical analysis of anything. That's how important Lars' contributions have been to the social sciences. Should not be undervalued. A fundamental contribution that has affected scholars and social scientists and everyone's lives since that seminal contribution. Now, within hours of the Nobel announcement, I was receiving dozens of emails from Lars students. And those students were all saying the same thing. Lars has deeply affected my life. I want to know how I can honor Lars at this very important moment in time. To me, that must have been the most gratifying period to Lars, because Lars is all about helping others. And I think Lars' life has shown us that hard work, perseverance, and a love for economics can accomplish a lot. Now, sometimes this work spills over to students. That guy happens to be one of Lars' PhD students. Anyone recognize that guy, that young guy? That's John Heaton. Yeah, he's a dean over at the business school, and the young man, I believe, is Lars' boy. Lars teaches at an early age how to build models. I am very proud to give you, Lars Hansen, my friend and colleague.
Thank you, John. Okay, we're good. Good to go. Okay, thank you very much. It's a lot of fun here to be able to talk in this wonderful classroom. John and I will be glad to declare this as the first lecture in this classroom. So he and I now have bragging rights. So we'll just declare them. Thank you very much for coming, and thanks for the comments from both John and Mark. So the first question is, you might ask is, who am I? I was like the, when the Nobel Prize got announced to the press, there was like Gene Fama, Bob Schiller, and that other guy. I'm the other guy. So here's two different images of me. This one here is interesting for the following reason. I was in bed the entire day. I was in the early stages of viral pneumonia, but the Nobel Committee has doctors. They drug you, so I got drugged up. I got escorted to the relevant event. They were hoping that I would stand upright and not keel over. The Nobel doctor was sitting on the front row just in case something happened. And you know, I even missed the rehearsal, but they trusted me anyway. So anyway, that was a memorable occasion for a variety of reasons. The other one's kind of interesting too. I have a student that's a former student that was from Czechoslovakia, and there was a newspaper article in Czechoslovakia with that portrayal. I guess it's supposed to indicate some of my multiple interests. It was actually in Czech, not English. It's been translated here for our purposes here. And that's the other image of me. I'm not sure I like either one of these images, but that's the one my students tend to think of, I guess. So I don't know. I'm not which is better. So in terms of alumni, I guess I myself have no University of Chicago degrees, which is my limitation. I do have some connection to U of C degrees. These are... A bunch of my graduate students were very kind to come back just in advance of Grace and I going to Stockholm, and they did a conference in my honor, and many of these are University of Chicago alumni from our PhD program. I've been proud to have about 60 PhD advisees, and I'm more than 100 other ones I've been in committees of. And they're all wearing this really silly T-shirt that I just showed you a picture of. So anyway, that was one of the most fun moments of the whole event. I do have other bragging rights for alumni. I have a 99 years ago, my grandfather got his medical degree from the University of Chicago. 76 years ago, my uncle, who's now 100, got his medical degree from the University of Chicago. And in a week, my son will get his undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago. So I got connections to three people. I was going to talk about the consequences of uncertainty, and I'm going to try to give a little bit of history of thought perspective, and try to bring it all. Also, try to bring in some. Relevant policy issues at the end that I think this is very much germane to. And in this talk, I have a great colleague in the statistics department, Steven Stigler, who's a world's expert in the history of statistics, and I've benefited from long conversations with him, as well as my colleague Jim Heckman and others in terms of thinking about this stuff. So let me start over 300 years ago. 301 years ago, I guess. That's Bernoulli. That's a picture of Jacob Bernoulli. If you look at probability theory before Jacob Bernoulli started working, it was all about games of chance. Okay? And these are games in which you knew what the probabilities were. It was like rolling dice, so you knew that a probability like 1/6 would come out, coin flips, and probability was all about doing calculations when you knew stuff, when you knew all the probabilities. Jacob Bernoulli was the first one who said, well, let's use these same type of models to think about social scientific data. And, of course, in social scientific data, we don't know the probabilities. We have to use data, and we have to figure out from data stuff about those probabilities. And so Jacob Bernoulli kind of develops the first version of what's now called the law of large numbers, which uses data to reveal probabilities. He actually established much more than this law of large numbers, but it's all about how much data does it take in order to figure out what probabilities are. And so a lot of what, you know, what I'd done in the first part of my professional career was all about trying to take economic models and take them to data. And so that's kind of, you know, kind of Jacob Bernoulli got this thing going. Now, there's this other part of this picture is a Pizarro picture, and it's a picture of a markets. I stole this from a cover of a book that Tom Sargent and I just recently published. But now what's that doing here? So the first part of my career, I'm spending time thinking about taking a model and taking it to data. The second, but that raised a lot of empirical challenges. And the empirical challenges has to do with people inside these models, they got to make decisions too. So just as I, outside the model, face outside uncertainty, people inside the models that I study and build, they also have to confront uncertainty. And so how do you want to think about both of these problems and how might they be connected and kind of what are the important questions attached to both of these perspectives? So that's kind of what I want to talk about. It's kind of like these different perspectives on uncertainty. So uncertainty in economic analysis, in my Nobel lecture, I try to draw a distinction between these two pieces, the kind of original Bernoulli piece, outside a model. Given some dynamic economic model, the researchers have to do things like estimate parameters and assess model implications. Then, we also have to look inside our models. So when we build our models, there's people inside our models. There's like actors, consumers, enterprises, policymakers. They also cope with uncertainty. Okay, so we have to take stands on that, and how they respond to that uncertainty has important consequences for market outcomes and kind of resource allocations. So there's uncertainty here from these two different vantage points. And as economic model builder who uses data, I have to think about both of these. And there's some interesting interplay between the two. So here's the field I'm in is from a statistical standpoint, it's called time series, and the pioneers of economic time series. So I've got some pictures here. Let me talk you about their contributions. Bachelet, back in 1900, was one of the first persons to kind of study the implications of how these so-called so-called normally distributed shocks would filter through in terms of dynamic systems. And his whole aim was to study asset markets, financial markets. This is back in 1900. He's doing this work. He comes up, along with Einstein and others, with this notion of Brownian motion. This goes back to Bachelet. Now, Bachelet's work, even though his specific motivation in his dissertation was about financial markets, it's completely unrecognized by economists for 50 years until Samuelson picks up on it. Samuelson's told about it from Savage. And what this does is it starts this notion of economists thinking about financial markets as these financial markets responding to these random shocks, or these random impulses that hit things, and somehow it's the role of financial markets to face or confront those shocks, and that has implications for prices and the like. Okay. Completely separately from this is Yule. So like Steven Stigler would call Yule as the founder of kind of time series statistics. Yule's not an economist. You'll study sunspots, okay? And the sunspot data, it's kind of not exactly periodic, but it's approximately periodic, and it has a cycle, I think, of like about eight years or so. And so Yule wants to build a model that deals cyclical phenomenon, but not exactly. And he does it by this very similar mechanism to Bachelet, they're shocks that hit a system, and then they kind of feed through the system in ways that are lead to this approximate periodic patterns to it. Okay? So Yule's doing this in 1927. It's funny, Yule's actually studying real sunspots. These days, economists have these, whenever they make reference to sunspots and dynamic models, they're supposed to be some type of bogus notions of uncertainty. But actually, Yule actually studied real sunspots and their consequences. Slutsky, who's famous for other contributions in price theory, also wrote a very fundamental paper coming out of Russia on time series. And so what Slutsky did was the following. He said, let's think more generally about the same type of problem that Yule's thinking. There's a bunch of random shocks, and they have implications that filter through dynamical systems, percolate through dynamical systems. So there's a shock today, a shock's going to affect things in future time periods and the like, and let's piece together a whole bunch of these shocks. There's repeated hitting by shocks, but they all have these kind of nice dynamic transmission mechanisms to them. So what Slutsky does is kind of very clever. It also is a little bit cheating too, but let's start with the clever part first. He takes some data from lotteries. This is his way to do a so-called Monte Carlo study. He goes to actual lottery data, and he takes that as his random variables, and then he feeds them through his models, showing that you can get approximate models designed to get these approximate periodic structures to them to try to imitate business cycles. He's got data on British business cycles, and so he wants to show his model actually looks like British business cycle data. So what does he do? Well, he has a plot in his paper that has a sequence of what outcomes of responding to this lottery data plotted against the actual business cycle data. And he says, look, they look very, very similar. Now you have to ask yourself, what would you have to do to have the actual shocks occurring in lotteries look just like the shocks that hit the actual economy? What's the chance of that happening? Not so likely. So what he had to do is produce a very, very long string of things and then sort through the whole string and then finally find one that looks like the British business cycle. So by modern day statistical analysis, this isn't quite the right way to do things. But it was a very impressive way to, it was a very impressive insight that he had that somehow you could take these random impulses and have them kind of percolate through a dynamic system and generate out really interesting patterns, including patterns that would explain business cycle data. Ragnar Frisch was the first Nobel laureate in economics, along with Tinbergen. And Frisch was very much into the work of Yule and Slutsky. But his aim was to build it to explicit economic models, not just to show these cyclical patterns, but actually build some explicit economics into it. He built these kind of tools that are now called impulse response functions that are used extensively. And he actually talked about how to use economics to explain some of the type of findings coming out of models that Yule and Slutsky were advocating. And so I think what's interesting, though, is that these three contributions are, Frisch was very much aware of Yule and Slutsky's work. Slutsky's work was done in 1927, but in Russian, but it got translated informally and finally published in English about a decade later in kind of Econometrica. Frisch is very much aware of these. The Bachelet connection doesn't come until much, much later, even though Bachelet's work was earlier. So what are the kind of challenges here that I want to think about? So the games of chance, the ones that kind of predated Bernoulli, are, think about them as over here. There's red balls, there's blue balls, and you know exactly how many balls there are, you draw them out at random. Known probabilities, you know how many balls are in there. Bernoulli says, well, that's really, for a lot of data, for social data, we don't know how many red and blue balls there are. We have to use the data to try to figure it out. And with repeated data, I can start figuring it out, and Bernoulli does calculations as how quickly you can figure it out. Now we go to time series. We go to dynamic, data relevant for how an economy evolves over time. Think about that as a case where there are these urns. You don't know how many balls are in each urn, and the urns themselves may change over time as well. So this is a third level of complexity, and this is the type of complexity which we really face in terms of thinking about how to model dynamic economies. So we pushed our way from the games of chance, where we know the number of balls, to not knowing the number of balls, to even maybe the urns themselves changing over time. And these become harder and harder challenges in order to try to go from data to figure stuff out. Okay, so here's a... This slide serves two things. Well, I want to make three points with this slide. One is the University of Chicago is a very harsh intellectual environment. So why do I say that? I wrote this book with Tom Sargent, a longtime collaborator who got the Nobel Prize a couple years before me. And this book has a picture, and the picture truncates right here. Okay? It just has that. And so we published this book. Steven Stigler writes a review article of kind of robustness and statistics. Our book's called Robustness. We want to apply it to economic models. And he points out that the author, that Sarge and I, truncated the key part of this painting by Latour. This is a painting called The Cheat, and basically missed the whole point of the painting. This is the theme of his, this is a key point made in his article. And then he sends me an email, don't worry, all publicity is good publicity. So what's this about here? Well, so we can start with a game of chance, okay? And here we have a game of chance. This person presumes it's a game of chance, but apparently something fishy is going on over there. And so the question is, if we're dealing with these probability models, and we kind of think one thing, maybe there's some chance they might be wrong. This person pretends they couldn't possibly be wrong, that the probabilities from a game of chance must be correct. But you know, suppose they actually might be wrong. Suppose we actually might not know what the probabilities are, and kind of how do we confront that? So I like to think about uncertainty and skepticism as somehow being connected. So here, so there's some very important contributions have come as I think coming out of this idea of decision theory. So what's decision theory? So decision theory writes down conceptual frameworks for how people make decisions in the place of uncertainty. There's a key insight in this whole literature due to Frank Knight, a very famous economist at the University of Chicago. Frank Knight wrote this book, and that's often cited, and I'm quite convinced that it's not very well read. Because, in fact, it's a very, very obscure book to read, and it's one of the hardest books I've ever tried to read, and it's not really very all that clear. But it's very, very heavily cited, and he draws a distinction, like I've talked about before, between a situation where you know probabilities and a situation in which you don't, and how that distinction have a very important ramifications for decision making. And so so kind of what do we do about that? Well, there's important contributions then that come from DiFinetti, who is an Italian statistician, and also from Savage, who is in the statistics department here. So before I tell you the contribution, this is going to go back to one of John List's discussions. Savage was in the statistics department here, and he left it. He left it for personal reasons, and a year or two later wanted to come back. His colleagues in statistics didn't want him back, and so he wasn't allowed back. If this were the Department of Economics, getting along with the colleagues isn't part of the prerequisites. In fact, it may be just the opposite. You're supposed to be difficult to get along with. But anyway, we'd welcome them back, I guess. But anyway, Savage and DiFinetti kind of combined work out this notion about what's called subjective uncertainty. In these situations where you don't know probabilities, then you kind of, through introspection, through other type of forms, you kind of formulate the corresponding sets of probabilities. Wald also lays out a whole formal decision theoretic framework for which you can then bring in these DiFinetti and Savage ideas into. And DiFinetti and Savage came up with intellectual justifications for what's now called Bayesian statistical approaches to both econometrics and statistics and the like. And the idea was that, well, in situations in which we really don't know stuff, we can kind of get started by some form of subjective uncertainty and then kind of learn from there. Now, this is a kind of a very elegant solution to this problem of uncertainty. But even DiFinetti, and it's often appealed to, and it's been incredibly powerful in actual applications. But even DiFinetti and Savage, in their own writing, would argue that, well, this approach, taken literally, is probably way too simplistic. And in fact, subjective probabilities can be very, very challenging to form to begin with, and there may be uncertainty about how we want to do those as well. So they provide an elegant solution, but they themselves are partially skeptical of the solution. I like to think about uncertainty then as having these different components to it. One is these probabilities. Okay? The probabilities given a model. So like in games of chance, you know all the probabilities, but there's still uncertainty because you know you flip a coin and you don't know there's heads or tails. Another piece of uncertainty. Well, you don't know the probabilities. You might use data to learn them. That's the type that was talked about by kind of DeFinetti and Savage. And then there's a third one, which I think is the most challenging and in many respects maybe the most important, and that is whenever we write down models, our models are wrong. I guess you're not supposed to say that, but it's true. They're wrong. They give along some dimension, the whole notion of a model is that it's an approximation of something. And so if you take the model literally, you're going to be making mistakes. So not only do you have uncertainty over which of the different models, all the models themselves, you should have appropriate skepticism with. And how do you confront that skepticism? How do you take the fact that the model itself shouldn't be taken so literally? And I think of those as three different important components to uncertainty. The game of chance, the not knowing which model, and acknowledge the fact that even when you have a set of models, they're not correct. And those are all, and I think all are critical to thinking about how people should respond to uncertainty. Okay. So now let's turn to this notion of investors inside a model. So when, as I indicated before, when we construct a dynamic economic model as a researcher, we've got to figure out how these economic actors behave, consumers, enterprises, policymakers, as they cope with uncertainty. So the challenge is, you know, as we look at through these different models of how people cope with uncertainty, there's been huge advances in decision theory and the like that help us think about these different issues, components of uncertainty I talked about. Then the challenge for an economist is to then deduce resulting market responses and the consequences for resource allocation. And what's coming out of this literature, kind of thinking about uncertainty much more broadly, is you get new sources for fluctuations in so-called uncertainty prices. And this is what's emerging. So in this, a common theme of the work of both Fama, Schiller, and myself is the fact that there's standard models when it came to financial markets had shortcomings, and had very, 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 very important shortcomings. And a piece of those shortcomings is the fact that these so-called risk prices fluctuate a lot over time. You know, it looks like markets are very, very risk-averse sometimes, so-called, and not very risk-averse in other times. Bad times, they look much more risk-averse than good times and the like. And to explain financial data, there have to be substantial fluctuations in that mechanism. And this is what comes out of empirical evidence. What's this recent work that I'm interested in is doing is saying, well, we don't, you know, whenever we try to say that economic agents inside the models have figured stuff out, they know probabilities, we get what looks like really anomalous behavior. But how about if we think about uncertainty more generally? People don't know what the models are. They also suspect the models they have aren't quite right. Those can provide additional sources of fluctuations, and I think it's a productive way to be thinking about this. So when you read in the financial press about markets being risk averse, I want to think about this as much more. People are uncertain about the future. Now we have lots of uncertainty about what the macro growth rate is going forward in time. We're not all that confident. The financial crisis shook up our views on what the various relevant models were and the like, and that itself has to be showing up in things like financial markets. And so I think that's a very important topic and one that I'm personally very fascinated with. Okay, so how about policy? So Hayek, who was at the University of Chicago, a very famous economist, got the Nobel Prize, wasn't good enough to be in the econ department, so was in the Committee of Social Thought. If you look at his Nobel address, there's this very interesting discussion about uncertainty in policy. There's a big bias, I believe, in discussing about policies in the press and the like. Is this the advisors who project incredible confidence that have the most influence? And I think that can be potentially dangerous. And so I think it's very critical going forward is that we embrace and understand that uncertainty is critical when we're thinking about making policy, you know, making policy assessments and not just shunt it to the side. So anyway, Hayek says, even if true scientists should even the limits of studying human behavior, as long as the public has expectations, there will be people who pretend or believe that they can do more to meet popular demand than what is really in their power. So it's this fact that, you know, there's a bit of an overconfidence bias sometimes in terms of the provision of, you know, selling policies and providing policy advice. Now, Hayek, if you read his Nobel Prize address, takes a more extreme position on this topic than I would. Hayek really doesn't like quantitative modeling in general because he thinks that economics is not up to the task. And I like to think about quantitative modeling as being critical, but we just have to do it in very, very sensible and cautious ways and not overstate what our findings are. In that sense, I'm a little bit closer to Friedman's view. And here's a quote. Well, this is Friedman quoting somebody else, Josh Billings. The trouble with most folks isn't so much their ignorance as knowing so many things that ain't so. Pertinent as this remark is to economics in general, it's especially so in monetary economics. And so this is kind of leading to my discussion of, you know, how about policy? When you start thinking about economic policy, so I've already described why this might matter in terms of explaining data, but how about in terms of thinking about policy? So let me, with the financial crisis, a new term has kind of become in the forefront. If you go to the pre-financial crisis, there's this term called systemic risk that was pretty much out of, there were very, very few references to it. Right? And this term has become a little bit like Justice Potter Stewart's view of pornography, under which if you, you kind of know it when you see it, but he's not going to tell you exactly what it is. And there's a little bit of that aspect of this as well. It's become a grab bag of scenarios rationalizing interventions in financial markets. And because of the financial crisis, there's been a rush towards embracing a concept of systemic risk in order to try to make this the guiding principle of financial oversight. There's no doubt that if we're going to be in the business of bailing out big financial institutions, they're going to have to provide some type of oversight. There's interesting discussions about how much we should be bailing them out and the like, but as long as we're in that business at all, there has to be some type of oversight. But what is a sensible type of oversight? And what is the dangers of pretending we have too much knowledge? I can assure you that, Andy Haldane from the Bank of England's written about this, Tarullo from the Board of Governors written about this. Our knowledge as academics of this concept of systemic risk remains somewhat meager. We're doing our best to learn about it. We're doing our best to understand more and more about it, but our knowledge is by no means advanced. And this is a case where kind of drawing this night, I think about this instead of risk, I think we have to think about this problem in much broader terms. Not stuff we figured out, but stuff that we really don't know about. We're unsure what the best model is for financial markets. We have to embrace that in terms of thinking about solutions. So early on in the financial crisis, I went to many different conferences that would talk about the systemic risk. And people would come out of these research departments from all the different feds and government agencies to say, this is a really complicated problem. Therefore, it requires a complicated solution. I would agree that kind of financial market oversight is a potentially complicated problem. But the point is that complicated problems do not necessarily require complicated solutions, especially when you have limited knowledge. The idea is that you write down some complicated model, work out what it tells you to do, and that model isn't quite correct, you might be doing more damage than good. And I think this is important to recognize. And this is kind of the point that Friedman and to some extent Hayek were both trying to get at. So this doesn't mean you don't do anything, but you recognize the limitations of your models and in terms of providing guidance. And you acknowledge the fact that there's some basic uncertainty. So here's a formula. We could talk about this formula if you want. This formula is basically out of Dodd-Frank, which is Basel III. I'm sorry. I would say this is Basel III is some international arrangement for how to do financial market oversight. I would say this formula is supposed to be evidence to you that Basel III is complex and not simple. So I will not go through this formula for you. But this is my superficial evidence of some complexity in financial market oversight. So now let's talk about monetary policy. So monetary policy, Friedman was, some of his most important contributions were in the realm of monetary economics. And Friedman would argue that we need simple monetary rules. Why? He would make the statement of long and his famous slogan of long and variable lags. And what he was trying to get at is the fact is that if we look at how monetary, the transmission mechanism for monetary policy, we're facing a lot of uncertainty. We really don't have a firm, complete understanding, at least in the time when Friedman was writing, of how that channel works. And therefore, it's a mistake to build policies that overstate how much we know about that mechanism. And given our limited knowledge of that mechanism, we should therefore be doing something simple rather than complicated. Now, monetary policy has changed dramatically since Friedman's time. It's got a completely different focus. It's shifted from monetary policy rules to interest rate rules. And kind of more recently to things like a principle called so-called forward guidance. So what's forward guidance? So interest rates kind of approximated the so-called zero lower bound. They came very, very close to zero. And once you get close to zero, then you can't keep on pushing them lower. And so forward guidance was meant to be this how to have influence by promising to do stuff in the future when certain conditions in the underlying macroeconomy change. And so the initial versions of forward guidance would make reference to when unemployment rates or both the behavior of unemployment and the behavior of inflation, and they would give kind of certain, under certain specifications, at that point in time, the Fed would start changing policies. It was an announcement of what it was going to do in the future based on the underlying market conditions. And there's a very important change of this that let me kind of put my Becker Friedman research director hat on for a moment. There's a very important change in that, at least a policy announcement of this that occurred. It occurred just in advance of this announcement. We held an event for undergraduates here with three of the Fed presidents. We had Charlie Evans from the Philadelphia Fed. We have Narayana Kachalakota from the Minneapolis Fed, and Charlie Evans from the Chicago Fed. They came here like a week or so in advance of the big policy announcement and statement, and they conducted an undergraduate panel which was the undergraduate moderator, and the entire target audience was undergraduates, and they took the time to both educate undergraduates about what they do, and then to disagree about what they should be doing going forward. But the education part was important, as well as the understanding that there's divergence of opinions. And all three of them kind of rose to the challenge to say, here's what we're doing. And our undergraduates, I think, benefited substantially from this event. We had probably maybe 150 to 200 undergraduates. And one of the things I'm most proud of for the Becker Friedman Institute is our outreach to undergraduates in a whole variety of forms. Now, think about this event that was challenging for us was getting them there. They wanted to negotiate exactly how long they would have to give uninterrupted statements and how much press coverage there would be, and there were disagreements. There was one of the presidents threatened not to come, and anyway, but finally things got calmed down. They all three got along very well, and we had a wonderful event. But anyway, let me kind of go back to this forward guidance. Right after that meeting was the first kind of formal statement of forward guidance under which there would be this, under what set of circumstances the interest rate rule would change from the zero lower bound to doing something else. If you follow the statements that have come out from the Fed since that time, this forward guidance is becoming increasingly more obscure. The set of circumstances under which they're going to act, you can no longer pinpoint it, and it's just that, well, whenever we think the time is right, then we'll do something. And that runs the danger, at least as far as I can see, of adding uncertainty to the situation rather than mitigating it. So I don't see this as a particularly great example either of either simple or transparent. It's certainly pushing away from a rules-based system into much more of a discretionary system. So I think I think this idea that part of policymaking should be to reduce uncertainty rather than to enhance it is something that we should keep on the radar screen and put pressure on our policymakers. So let me kind of in conclusion just summarize what I hope some of the messages that we can get out of today's talk. One is, I like to think of there being two perspectives of uncertainty. One is this outside the model perspective. A policymaker takes the models we build and tries to do stuff with them. Econometricians have to tell you, kind of how much do we know about certain parameters and how well does the model fit the data. But we also have to face inside the model. We have people inside our model, investors, enterprises. They have to make decisions. They also confront uncertainty, and we have, then we have to model those. I like to think of there about three components to uncertainty. Risk. Risk is this notion of games of chance. You know the probabilities, but they use those probabilities to make guesses about the future. So you're given a model. The model tells you how to assign probabilities. I like to think about a second component is model ambiguity. How much confidence do we have in each of our alternative models? And that statement of confidence means that we have to somehow figure out how to weight those models and kind of how much attention do we pay to each of the ones. A third one is model misspecification. The models we use are not perfect. How do we use models that are not perfect in ways that are sensible? So I think these are the three components of uncertainty. And each one is kind of increasingly more difficult to analyze, but I think arguably the third one might be the most important. Finally, given our limits to our understanding, complicated problems may be best addressed by simple solutions and not necessarily complicated ones. With that, I thank you very much for your time and open it up to questions.
Can you take a question?
Yeah, sure. Are there questions? Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Or
yes.
Right.
Yeah. Fair enough. Simplicity might be in the eyes of the beholder, right? So that's an interesting question. So one part of simplicity that I think is important is if we think about the oversight of financial institutions. Those financial institutions have a lot of very, very smart people working for them. And the feds have also some smart people working for them. But if there's going to be a game, if there's going to be a game played between the smartness, more money is going to come from the private sector than the public sector. So the best hope of that one is to give the public sector people simple things, much more simple challenges to be doing and not stuff that requires lots of subtlety and complexity, because they're not going to win that game. But I agree with you. The general point. I've not been rigorous in my statement of simplicity. But the simplicity has to be not just to some academic economist. It has to be to the public. Absolutely. Yes.
Is a carbon tax a simple solution?
I like a carbon tax. I'm personally a supporter of that. I think it's a wise and smart idea. I think there's lots of evidence of externalities from carbon, both for the climate, for foreign policy, and the like, and I think the carbon tax is a potentially simple solution to the problem. So, that's my view. How about yours? Question back there? Yeah. Yeah. I think in general, I should say this issue about how to have design policies in the face of the, we know a lot about the first one because that's standard decision theory. We know less about these two, and these are the two that I think are important challenges going forward. I do think that we have to somehow get over this bias that we have in terms of asking our politicians to go locate and find advisors that will project themselves with excessive confidence and not acknowledge the fact that we don't fully understand things. And I haven't thought through the political economy to kind of make all that happen in the right way. I think it's tremendously important for us as a society to understand that it's a mistake for us to pretend to go seek out people because we think they know, because we somehow feel better that they know stuff when indeed they may not know it well. And that it's possible for intelligent people to get up there and give good policy advice without having to claim they know everything there is out there. What's the right way to construct the political incentives for all this to work best is a great question, and but I don't have a wonderful answer for you. Yes? So Friedman, you know, monetary policy at the time when Friedman was doing it is very different than monetary policy now. So Friedman wanted to have a very simple monetary policy rule, and I think in the time he was writing, it was a sensible thing to be doing. When Friedman was writing, it kind of predated the shift from these monetary policy rules to interest rate rules, and we shifted much more to interest rate policies. I do agree that with the basic principle that, the financial crisis caught, you know, there's lots of economists that go out there and say that they predicted the financial crisis, and a lot of this is ex post, and a lot of it is, and even people who thought there might be a problem, I think most of them were surprised about the magnitude of the problem. So when everyone says that they predicted the financial crisis, you should ask them exactly what consequences they predicted of it. So the financial crisis caught us by surprise. I think there's no doubt about it. And perhaps at that point in time, I think that Chairman Bernanke and the Fed had to do some special things in order to provide liquidity and the like, and they had to do some ad hoc things. So in times of extreme events, I do think that some type of discretion is absolutely critical. But the thing is, in general, I think you want a rule-based system and rules that are relatively simple. Are kind of a good way to go. So I agree with Friedman's basic insight that we want going forward monetary policy rules that have a very simple character to them. Yes?
It seems like no economists are paying much attention to changes in the nominal money stock, rates of growth, etc.
Yeah.
If so, what's caused that? And two, it seems like however you define monetary policy, even ignoring changes in money stock, whether you look at interest rates, economists seem to say it's been very expansive for a long period. Mm-hmm. Perhaps a decade or longer, and yet relatively no inflation.
Yeah.
Perhaps maybe the last 6 months.
Right.
So can you comment on those two aspects?
Yeah, for like an hour or two.
You have only 3 minutes.
Yeah. So I think it's a real question about kind of, things have been expansive, and at what point in time do we really have to be worried about inflation kicking in? And I think a big concern is, you know, there's not a lot of evidence of big inflation on the horizon, but could it kind of become an issue fairly quickly and kind of catch us a surprise and kind of take off? And I think there's some chance that could actually happen. Part of what the Fed has now that it hasn't had in the past is the ability to pay interest on the deposits of the various banks. And they can kind of control things that way. But the question is, at one point in time, is the public going to tolerate the Fed handing out lots of money to banks, deposits at the Federal Reserve without saying, you know, why are we subsidizing banks again? So there'll be political challenges to that as well. I'm hopeful that the Fed has all this is making the right calculations on this front, and I'm hopeful that inflation doesn't become a big issue and that they've got the tools to stop it from being one. But we are in a situation now that's different than we've been in the past history, so there is reason to be uncertain about that. So. Yes, I'm done.
I know you'll agree with me when I say that due to your attendance and Lars's insights and John's contributions, this first academic lecture is a complete success. I hope you'll come toast that success with us at a reception in the Graduate Student Commons. Lars will be there. Best way to get to talk to him is to go up to the Commons, follow the guidance of the staff outside, and from the Commons, we'll be offering tours of the building, which I hope you'll enjoy. Thank you all for coming.